Welcome to It's True or Is It? A podcast that mixes fact and fiction, then tries to sort them out again. Your hosts are Michael Pryor and George Ivanov. Hello, everybody, and welcome to It's True or Is It? My name is Michael Pryor.
And my name is George Ivanov.
George, what's our topic for this episode?
Our topic for this episode is medicine.
Ah, the wonderful world of medicos and physicians and disease and all of that.
Oh, yeah, all the gruesome stuff.
I've actually broadened it out a little bit into this idea of biology because they sort of go hand in hand.
Yeah, look, I've done the same thing with mine, and this is a topic that I have particularly liked because I didn't actually have to do any research for this one, having written a book on this very topic.
Tell me about the book, George.
The Human Body Survival Guide, the second book in my trilogy of non-fiction kids' books. And it very much focused on all the gross aspects of the human body. And
that's what we call high interest, isn't it, when you get into grocery?
Indeed. Mm. So now, I just went to that book, pulled it off the shelf, had a bit of a reread and surprised myself with everything that I'd forgotten.
So if we had to add citations and references to this episode, it would be full of George Ivanov.
Yeah, I'd be citing myself. How's that?
Now, I'll tell you a little bit about my background here because many, many years ago at university, I did a half-year subject called The History of Public Health and Germ Theory.
Oh, wow, that sounds interesting.
It was fascinating. I loved it, partly because it was so totally non-vocational. Mm. You do that subject, it wasn't promising you a job or anything. So it's just pure intellectual stimulation. So I've drawn on some of that, not necessarily directly that material, but some of that impulse for interest in the way we've coped with diseases over the years. So, George, now, can you remind the listeners out there of the format of It's True?
Well, we each present three facts, in inverted commas, on the topic that we have chosen. And two of those facts will be absolutely true. They will actually be facts, whereas one of them will be a fiction disguised as fact.
Now, we don't know what each other is presenting. No. So this is totally, totally new to us both.
Yes.
I'm going to try to fool you and the listeners out there, and you are going to try to fool me.
Indeed I am.
Well, George, I have got my super sceptical cap on.
As do I.
So would you like to present your first story to us?
Well, you know, I like to give you the choice. So the choice of topics today are poo transplants, gallbladder removals, and human hairballs.
This is really sounding like an icky top 10.
As I said, my book was entirely devoted to the gross aspects of the human body, so, you know.
Let's go gall.
Okay. So the removal of a gallbladder is called, if I can pronounce this correctly, a cholecystectomy. And they're a fairly common operation because the human body can survive, you know, reasonably well without a gallbladder. And it's most commonly removed because of gallstone problems. Mm. Now, the very first successful cholecystectomy was conducted by Karl Langenbruch at the Lazarus Hospital in Berlin on July 15, 1882. Mm. So they removed the gallbladder from this person who had lots of gallstones, and he made a full recovery and everything was wonderful. The procedure was controversial at the time, because people weren't keen on removing things that might be useful in the body, and there was, you know, some, you know, skepticism over whether it's a good thing to remove an organ or not.
It always surprises me the sorts of bits and pieces we can lose and go on quite perfectly.
Well, it was all based on some 17th century studies done on dogs, where they removed gallbladders and found that the dog survived perfectly well. So this is it's no wonder there was a little bit of controversy and skepticism over the fact that this guy was going to remove a gallbladder based on a 17th century study on dogs.
I've read of some of the awful things they tried on dogs before they tried them on people. Yeah, I feel really, really sorry for the poor pups. But
the whole animal experimentation thing is really horrid. Anyway, so that was the first, like, successful gallbladder removal. Of course, prior to that, there were some unsuccessful gallbladder removals. And what I'm focusing on today is the earliest known record of a gallbladder removal. And we're going way, way back in time to a chap called Hippocrates. You may have heard of him, the Hippocratic Oath.
Very much so, yeah.
So he's often regarded as the father of medicine. He's the guy who suggested that we needed to actually study the symptoms of the person and conduct examinations and come up with a prognosis and all of this sort of stuff.
He was the one who said, first, do no harm, which sounds like a good basic principle for medicos everywhere.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Don't hurt your patient as a first step.
And he did a lot with the systematic categorization of diseases. Of course, he's also the guy who came up with the theory of the four humours and their effects on the human body, the blood, phlegm, yellow bile and black bile.
So ups and downs with Hippocrates.
Yeah, so I'm going to focus here on the yellow bile.
It's already sounding disgusting.
Yeah, yeah. So the yellow bile was associated with a choleric nature, ambitious, decisive, aggressive, and short-tempered. And it was thought to be found within the gallbladder. So he thought it might be a good idea to try removing one.
To see if it would change someone's temperament.
Yes. So in a case of, like, severely excessive yellow bile, he started off with dead bodies, okay?
Okay.
All right. So people who had supposedly died because of an excessive yellow bile, and he opened them up and he thought, okay, yeah, that's the problem there. It's the gallbladder. Hmm. You know, it's probably not a great idea to generally remove one, but, you know, if you're going to die anyway and this might save you, it's probably worth a go. Well, he made one attempt at it, and the patient died during the operation. The lack of anaesthetic might have had something to do with that, I'd say.
Yeah.
I could not find any information on exactly how this was conducted, like whether they got the poor patient drunk or whether they rendered him unconscious.
Basically, the pre-anaesthetic operations, how they were done was fast.
Yes. So that may have had some impact on things as well. The speed with which he conducted the operation, maybe he didn't do everything that should have been done. Anyway, short story is that he operated, the guy died, and he didn't do it again.
So that's our little history of gallbladder stuff.
Yes.
It's convincing. I
mean, there were lots of other unsuccessful gallbladder removals over the years.
Until our
successful removal, whose name now escapes me because the sheet isn't in front of me. Karl Langenbruch.
Yeah.
German fellow.
Yes.
At the Lazarus Hospital in Berlin.
I was thinking that was 1880. That was the date.
1882.
Okay. And that, I'm really racking my history brains here to think, is that anaesthetic or
anaesthetic? Yeah, just.
Early days of anaesthetic.
Early days of anaesthetic, yes.
Those are the ones where they weren't quite sure if they're going to wake up or not.
Yeah, I did almost do appendectomies rather than cholecystectomies because the appendectomies actually began before anaesthetic.
George, say it again.
Appendectomy.
The other one.
Oh, cholecystectomy.
Cholecystectomy. That is pretty cool. Yeah. It just rolls off the tongue.
I don't know. It didn't roll off my tongue. It took an awful lot of practice and listening to Google pronounce it for me first.
Yeah, yeah. Essential backup, that. All right, George. So, convincing. Look, I've put that one high on my convincing-o-meter. And we'll have to wait to the other two, of course, to see how they go.
Indeed.
But has the ring of truth about it. Now, I'll roll into my very first anecdote, story, vignette, And this is an actual medical case from the past. This is the very famous case of Phineas Gage, which I'm hoping you haven't heard of. In 1848, Phineas Gage was an American railway worker supervising the blasting of rocks.
Railway gauges!
Not quite the same gauge. Oh. I hadn't thought of that pun. I should have built that in somewhere. Railway gauge. Couldn't find a man of his calibre. Something. All right. But he was the supervisor for the blasting of rocks to prepare the way for the Rutland and Burlington Railroad in the US state of Vermont. He was using a metre-long iron bar to pack the blasting powder into a hole, which was bored in the rock, when the bar sparked against the side of the hole. His head happened to be in truly the wrong place at the wrong time. The explosion sent the bar hurtling back out of the hole and right through Phineas Gage's head, entering his cheek and exiting through the top of his skull. The iron bar actually landed 25 metres away, so this was no small explosion. Now, the remarkable thing is that Phineas Gage survived. In fact, after being unconscious for a few minutes, he sat up, spoke, and then walked to the cart that took him to wait for the local doctor. When the doctor arrived half an hour later, Gage said, "Doctor, here is business enough for you." Which, when you think about it, is pretty cool one-liner for someone with a fair part of his brain missing. He received the medical treatment that was available in 1848, being sewn and patched up, basically. He lost an eye, some teeth, and let's not beat about the bush. A fair part of his brain was on the floor. But he was alive and able to function, and he became a minor celebrity, if you like. Lots of reports around that are around after his accident said that Phineas Gage had a drastic personality change because of this accident.
Surprising!
And before the encounter with the iron bar, said that he was hard-working, conscientious, and all-round good guy. Well, afterwards he became unreliable, shifty, and borderline psychopathic. But those accounts are generally held to be hugely exaggerated. His general memory and intelligence, it's agreed, were unimpaired by this accident.
Interesting.
In the years immediately after the accident, he was reported to be moody and impatient.
Well, I understand.
But maybe that was more like PTSD than actual brain injury. Phineas Gage died in 1860, some 12 years after the accident, after living 12 years relatively unremarkably. He held down jobs, he had relationships, he spoke and talked, and yet his forebrain was mostly mushed.
I'm finding this one difficult to believe. One generally assumes that if you remove a large chunk of a person's brain, they're not going to be able to function to, you know, 100% capacity.
I left out some of the gorier details.
No. Don't leave out the gory details.
The bits of brain that were scattered around and so on. And it was extraordinary to think, one, that he even survived, but then went on to live a reasonably normal life. And he has become a signal example, a signal case that are referred to again and again in medical literature to this day about brain injury. What happens when different parts of the brain are injured. They've tried to reconstruct exactly what part of the brain was injured, because for a while there, they still had his skull after he died. Mm. I think it went on one of those travelling circuses or something, because basically you could see the big hole at the top of his skull.
So before they patched him up, did they take the opportunity to have a little bit of a peek inside?
They did.
Look at this.
Yeah. When I look at usual brains, there seem to be bits there that aren't here anymore. Where are they? Oh, they're over there.
Medical history is kind of riddled with accidents that have allowed for the further study of things. There's vague memories of a case of this guy got shot in the stomach and ended up with a big hole in his stomach, and the treating doctor ended up paying the guy a yearly amount of money in order to allow him to be studied. and, you know, dipping bits of food on a string into his stomach to see the effect of digestion and stuff. So an awful lot was learned about digestion because of that guy.
And Phineas Gage has been one of those examples, one of those paradigm cases that they use for studying, thinking about the whole idea of brain injury, and more to the point, what parts of the brain control what functions. And so there's a feeling that, yeah, a big chunk went out, but it wasn't the memory, the intelligence, the speech parts of the brain. And started to get those 19th century doctors thinking about this idea of different parts of the brain control different functions. So there's Phineas Gage from 1848. Iron bar through the head, yeah, no problem.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced by that one.
As is your prerogative, George. So let's have a listen to your second story.
Well, do you want human hairballs or do you want poo transplants?
Yeah, I'm sorry, but I'm leaving poo till last. So
wise decision.
Let's go with the hair.
Okay, I'm going to start with a story. In August 2019, a 14-year-old girl in Indiana was admitted to hospital with abdominal pain, vomiting. Yep, severe pain. Doctors then examined her and discovered a large hairball in her stomach. So in they went.
Hairball, like cats
like,
get
like
hairball.
Like a cat hairball in her stomach. Okay. So doctors went in and operated to discover a 1.3-kilogram hairball wedged in her stomach and extending into her small intestine.
George, I'm making appropriate sounds of astonishment here and a face that can only be described as incredulous. Mm-hmm. But go on.
The hairball was removed. They sewed her back up and she was perfectly fine thereafter. Now, bizarre as it all sounds, it's actually not that uncommon an occurrence. And it's all down to something that is called Rapunzel syndrome.
Okay.
Whereby people have the habit of sucking on or eating their own hair.
Now, I've seen young girls, especially with long hair, just one corner and corner of the mouth, just like, totally unconsciously. They don't realise they're doing it.
Indeed. I mean, you have to do it to a fairly severe extent to get enough hair into you to create this hairball, which, by the way, is medically known as a trichobasal.
Ah.
So you have heard of basils?
Yeah, I mean, who hasn't, George?
Well, if you've ever read the Harry Potter books, they are the cure-all that can overcome any poison and stuff. And there is a history of basils in witchcraft and in, you know, in healing in the Middle Ages.
Highly sought after they were.
Yeah. But basically, a basil is a tightly packed collection of partially digested or undigested material that most commonly occurs and lodges in the stomach. Mm-hmm. And there are a number of different types of basils. There are, let's see if I can pronounce these, a lactobasal, which comes from milk protein and mucus. They can occur in milk-fed infants. There are foreign body basils, which form from parasitic worms, plastic, paper, and polystyrene foam cups.
In someone's stomach. Oy.
There are phytobasils, which comprise of indigestible food fibres like cellulose from various different types of vegetables. There are pharmacobasils, which are another type that forms from medications that don't properly dissolve in the digestive tract. And most of those medications contain aluminium hydroxide gel. Then there are diospirobasils, which form from persimmon fruit.
It's got its own specific...
And now I love persimmons, and I am never eating a persimmon again after having done this research. And, of course, there are the trichobasils, which form from human hair.
So, yeah, you've really ramped up the disgusting quotient nicely there,
Thank
George.
You.
In
Thank
an appropriate
you.
Manner.
And I'll ramp it up some more for that final one.
Yeah, that's certainly sad. So people who munch on their own hair, mm-hmm. it accumulates in stomach, makes this big mass, which sometimes needs surgical removal.
That's correct.
That sounds totally plausible. Or is it?
That is for you to decide. All right, so what's your next one then?
Next one, we're moving into the world, moving away from some of the grossness of bodily issues into the world of the mind. We're looking at a psychiatric disorder here, George. So this is somewhat solemn and sobering.
Well, it leads on from mine, you know, because the Rapunzel syndrome is a psychiatric.
So there's our link. Okay, and I'm going to introduce to you, I hope, this whole idea of the glass delusion. This is a strange psychiatric disorder where the sufferer thinks they're made of glass and that they could shatter at any moment. Now, this is well documented. It's actually documented historically. It was because it was mostly recorded from the Middle Ages through to the 16th and 17th centuries, when glass, when you think about it, was becoming more widely available, but probably still the province of the wealthy, the rich people. And so it was the nobles, the aristocrats, who tended to suffer from this delusion. So the most notable person who suffered from glass delusion was probably King Charles VI of France, 1368 to 1422. He was said to have muffled himself in blankets to prevent his buttocks from breaking when he sat down. And he had his clothing specially reinforced with iron rods to protect himself when he was really in the grips of this delusion. For much of the time, he wouldn't allow anyone to approach him because of his fragility. In a closely related delusion in the 1840s, the 23-year-old daughter of King Ludwig I of Bavaria, her name was Princess Alexandra Amalie, was convinced that as a child she'd swallowed a full-sized grand piano made entirely of glass. It was now resting inside her and would shatter if faced with any sudden movement, so she had to walk very slowly and deliberately through the royal palace.
That's a heck of a delusion.
Yeah, well, what can you say? Royals, eh?
Inbreeding.
The glass delusion, George, a documented and established psychiatric disorder.
And I've got to relate this to pop culture. It just makes me think of a film called Unbreakable, in which the villain was glass. Glass, and he had a rare bone disease which caused his bones to shatter with any sort of minor impact.
And that is absolutely true. There are people with a brittle bone disease. Yes. I went to school with a lad who had that and was very unfortunate and had to take very special care. And even after he took special care, his bones would break just by looking at them almost. So the glass delusion, George, some people who think they're made of glass. These psychiatric disorders, I had so many to choose from.
Oh, yeah, there's a plethora of them out there, aren't there? And some of them are just so bizarre. I've got to ask, with King Louis, did he suffer from this his entire life, or is it something that he developed later on, or what?
Later on, but it waxed and waned. And it was felt that he had some really serious psychiatric issues going on. And this was one manifestation of them. So, yes, he would descend into this feeling that he was made of glass for months at a time, and then it would slowly dissipate and he would be off talking to trees or something next.
But, I do say it would be a rather frightening thing to have. You'd have to be so careful, like, all of the time. And I think it would be rather distressing.
And he was. He was very distressed about it. And as a result, the obsession meant that he couldn't govern the kingdom very well. Nothing else was important apart from stopping his buttocks from breaking. All right, George. Now, your number three?
My number three, fecal transplants. Okay, so there are lots of good bacteria in your digestive system, all the way from your stomach to your intestines. But sometimes bad bacteria take over and cause problems. And there is an intestinal disease called, and my pronunciation of this is going to be like all over the place, Clostridium difficile infection.
Okay.
which causes severe diarrhea and is difficult to treat because it is resistant to so many of the antibiotics out there. So, someone came up with the brilliant solution to invite somebody else's poo bacteria to come over and restore the bacterial balance in the afflicted person.
Put up the signs and say, good bacteria, welcome here. What, how do you do this?
Well, you transplant it.
Ah.
It's officially called a fecal microbiota transplant and is basically a poo transplant.
I can figure two ways you could get.
Oh, there's poo. More than two ways. There is more than two ways. See, and I've got to tell you about them all.
This is why I'm not a doctor.
So the poo is collected from a healthy donor.
So with their knowledge,
one would assume. Imagine being a poo donor. I wonder if they pay you for that. I should have looked into that. I didn't think.
Yeah.
Okay, so the poo is collected. It's then mixed with a special solution, strained, and then introduced into the system of the sufferer in one of several ways.
Yeah, geez, introduced into the system of the sufferer. That covers a lot of a lot of detail.
And let me tell you, they just go from bad to worse.
Mm-hmm.
So there is, number one, via colonoscopy. That is delivered to your large intestine with a flexible tube that goes up your bottom. Alternatively, we can go in the other end with an endoscopy, delivered to your small intestine with a long, flexible tube that goes down your mouth or nose through your esophagus and to your stomach.
Sounding really pleasant.
Mm. If that's not your thing, you can always have it delivered via an enema.
Mm-hmm.
So basically, squirt it up your bottom with a large syringe.
Mm.
If that doesn't appeal, you can always swallow.
Delivered to your small intestine
with around about 30 capsules containing freeze-dried poo.
Oh, okay. I was imagining something else.
No. Freeze-dried capsules. So freeze-dried poo in capsules. That actually to me sounds like the less offensive way of having it introduced into your system.
Yeah.
Anyway, this procedure was developed in the 1950s and has been used regularly ever since, although there are records of similar transplants being carried out by Chinese doctors as early as the 4th century. I couldn't find any actual information of how they actually did it back then, but given the fact that they couldn't, with that technology of freeze-dried stuff into capsules... shudders to think how they actually got it into people's systems.
Some Chinese doctor thinking, I've got someone here who's not very well, let's feed them poo, is not beyond the borders of possibility.
No, and look, there's all sorts of weird stuff that was done in early times and is still done that works. I mean, leeches are a good example of that. Maggots to clean wounds. All sorts of things that, may seem counterintuitive at first glance actually have, medicinal benefits.
Hmm. All right. So poo transplants. Yeah. I managed to say that without wincing.
Congratulations. I still haven't managed that.
Okay, so now I'm going deep into the human biology aspect here. Medical, it's borderline medical, I'm sure. And you know that it's been found that around about 1% of people have Neanderthal DNA, right?
Oh, I did not know that.
Yep. They've done the studies, and as more and more people are getting their DNA sampled and scanned these days, they do find out that, the Neanderthals are here, they've always been here, they're with us.
Well, there are quite a number of politicians out there that I would believe this of.
There we go. So 1% of people definitely have Neanderthal DNA. But just recently, very recently, it's been found that about 0.0001% of people have canine DNA buried somewhere in their genome. Mm. Now, we've been living side by side with dogs for so long, some transference has happened. And it's suspected, but not proven, that it's gone the other way too, human to dog.
I'm having very unwanted visions of how that might have happened.
Transference. You use the word transference in your poo story. So there are, how do they put it, mechanisms.
I'm sure there are.
Now, it's been suspected, as I said, that not proven that it's gone the other way too, from human to dog. So dogs have some tiny, tiny, tiny proportion of human DNA in their makeup. Now, this might explain, now we get into the realm of speculation. You know how scientists, they do this. They find something that's pretty interesting, and then they have the evidence for it, and then without the evidence, they sort of go off on these wild speculations. And this might explain why some owners look like their pet dogs and why some dogs are so good at understanding us and understanding our speech and our gestures, and other species aren't.
You've blown it with that. I'm sorry. That is the bit which has made me incredulous of this one.
You wouldn't think that some scientists would start speculating like that. Now, come on.
No.
The speculation, of course, hasn't extended to the world of cats. There is no danger of cat DNA getting into human DNA. They're too aloof. There are my three stories from the world of medicine. Do you want me to give you a quick recap?
Yeah. Give me a quick recap and then I'll make my choice.
Okay. First of all, I entertained you with the story of Phineas Gage and the iron bar through the head. Extraordinary but true. Then we went to the glass delusion, where people honestly believe that they are made of glass and could shatter at any moment. Astounding but true. And then we had the idea that canine DNA has somehow made its way into human DNA. Extraordinary, but true.
Yes. Well, look, the glass delusion, I reckon, is a definite truth, I think. But I'm having a hard time choosing between the other two. I find it hard to believe that someone could exist as well as they did with a portion of their brain missing. And I also find the canine DNA just a little past my point of credulity. And I can't pick two of them, can I?
Nope, one.
Oh, gosh. And invariably I'm going to pick the wrong one, but I'm going to go with the canine DNA as being incorrect.
George, you've hit the nail on the head. I think this is the first time in our three episodes that either of us have picked the fake story.
Yay me.
That was a story, was a step too far, was it?
Yes. And as I said, the thing which really did it was the speculation about pets looking like their owners. That doesn't connect.
But as a principle, that idea that scientists, they do find really good things.
And then they speculate on it.
Oh,
on that.
Goodness me, do they?
Yeah.
All right, so I'm saying that Phineas Gage was actually true. Mm. Absolutely true, and that's relatively famous in the annals of medicine. With all of these true stories, loyal listeners out there, go and follow them up, really, because you'll find more information out there. And we've only scratched the surface on some of them. But Phineas Gage is an extraordinary story. Extraordinary story of what the brain is capable of when a big chunk of it is missing.
Yeah, that is utterly fascinating. Mm. Difficult to believe, but fascinating.
And gruesome.
And gruesome, yes.
All right, George, now give me a little bit of an overview of your three.
We had gallbladder removal.
I remember, yes.
We had human hairball.
Yes.
And we had poo transplant. So we've gone from one ooky thing to another to the most ooky of the lot.
Yeah, I think we scaled the ladder of ookiness as we went through your three. And in a way, I was about to say the most medical of them was the gallbladder one, because they, operation, but the hairball one was full of operations too.
Yes.
And can we say the poo transplant was full of procedures?
Yes, most definitely, yeah. Procedures.
Yes, but
none of them very appealing.
No, they're not appealing, but if they can help people with some of those issues downstairs, well and good, and worth trying. But no, hair, I've heard about hair. I'm sure I've heard about hair. Perhaps I'm thinking of cats, but I'm going gallbladder. I'm going to say gallbladder. No. Just a little bit out there on the edge of believability.
Congratulations. You too have picked the incorrect.
So we're story. 2 for 2 today.
Yeah. How amazing is that?
That is extraordinary.
And again, as always, I couched it in a lot of facts. So the first successful operation was indeed performed by Karl Langenbruch.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But yeah, Hippocrates did a lot of questionable stuff, but he did not try to remove people's gallbladders.
As you say, I'm just thumping my forehead because I do remember Hippocrates was basically against surgery.
Mm.
He did not believe in cutting people open to do anything.
Yep.
So
A bit of a dead giveaway.
So I'd forgotten all about that until just this moment.
But it fits so nicely in with his theories of the yellow bile accumulating in the gallbladder, which he really did believe.
And as soon as you mention Hippocrates, it adds weight to believability because so much of medical principles go back to him.
Yeah.
I think we're winding up episode 3 of It's True or Is It?
Indeed, we are.
And so, George, as a bit of a preview taster, what have we got next episode?
Next episode, we are going close to home and talking about Australia, mate.
A wide brown land, droughts and flooding rain. We're sure to come up with some excellent stories about Australia.
Indeed, I'm looking forward to researching it.
And so much weird stuff happens in Australia, I think it's going to be easy to slip a fake by you.
Oh, yes.
So for now, though, it's goodbye from me, Michael Pryor.
And from me, George Ivanov.
And stay tuned to It's True or Is It? And that was the It's True or Is It podcast with Michael Pryor and George Ivanov. If you want to know more about Michael's books, podcasts and other projects, go to www.michaelpryor.com.au. And for George's books, writing and other projects, pop over to georgeivanov.com.au. Now, we'll be back next time with more amazing facts, more amazing falsities, and remember, it's true or is it? This podcast was recorded on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung people. We recognise their continuing connection to land, waters and culture.